Hello everybody, welcome to Science Question Time at Science Online London. Science Question Time is a regular debate meetup event that happens so far only in London, but we hope to go national in the next year. We've been running only about 9 months, and we really are mainly for the community of people who are interested in science policy, which can be a bit insular and can get a bit geeky. So we're really delighted to have an opportunity to have a mini version here, where we hope we can have a much more diverse a debate with people who are just as interested in the issues that we talk about but maybe aren't within the same community. We've invited four science policy interested parties who are going to offer some ideas about questions in science policy. We're called Science Question Time. We normally have debate around a particular topic. So we've had ones on funding and education and higher education policy and this thing called impact, which certainly in the UK is something we all worry about a lot. But I'm sure you can imagine the idea of research impact and all the arguments that might go around that term, whatever country you're from. What we want to do here is slightly different. Rather than offering a topic and you asking our panel questions and then maybe them throwing some back at you, the questions here are going to be the main focus of the debate. The point is to find new questions that we should be asking of science policy. So it's not just these ready-made themes of education or research impact or open access, but what themes we should be focusing on. What are the key questions for the year ahead in science policy? So each of our panellists in turn are going to offer two that they think are important. We'll have, after each of them, you can ask them any clarification questions if you don't understand what they're saying. And after all four of them, I'm going to open up the debate for you and you can tell us what you think of those questions. Maybe refine them, maybe say that they're rubbish, maybe say that they're brilliant, or maybe offer completely different ones. I'd be really keen to hear new ones from you that you think we should be asking. And we will try and collect all of these and bring them back to the professional science policy community so they pay attention to how you think the debate should be framed. Does that make sense? Oh, I'll just say who I am. I'm Alice Bell. I write freelance about science and society, and I also teach science communication at Imperial College, and I'll take my phone away. And if any of you want to use the hashtag SciQT, that is also, or I hope there'll be some debate around that hashtag as well as the Science London one. But I'll start off with Jack Stilgo, who is, I'll let him introduce himself and I'll let him introduce his questions as well.
Thank you, Alice. I'm at the University of Exeter where I research on science policy. I was previously chained to a radiator in the Royal Society's Science Policy Centre. And then before that was at a think tank called Demos. So I've sort of moved in and around the world of science policy for a number of years. And asked to think about what the big things are in the year ahead. I mean, for me, this is the sort of question that I don't have an answer to, because anybody that works in science policy knows the folly of prediction that scientists too often fall victim to. But I would say that the big questions of science policy are going to be the old questions of science policy. Biggest of all is the question of what is science for. The question that gets constantly discussed, will never be resolved, about which scientists, interest groups, members of the public, institutions, governments will always disagree, but about through the healthy discussion of which should lead to robust science policies. Now, clearly, the new context in which the question of what is science for is being asked is a context in which, following last year's spending review, we are now, after 10 good years, looking at 10 fallow years. We are looking at a return to the steady state idea of science in which there is very little new money for new research. And so the question of how we divide up the cake becomes more and more important. It's been sort of kept below the surface for the last decade or so as expenditure has been rising. But now, as we've seen over the last couple of weeks, and hopefully Stephen will be able to say a bit more about this if you prod him hard enough, as we've seen with EPSRC's trials and tribulations that they've got into with members of their community getting rather aggrieved that EPSRC are planning to cut back their funding. This will be a more and more important discussion. Now, once you have had that conversation about the ends of science, what is science for, the second big question is one of, well, how do you achieve it? What are the means of science policy? And there, the question, the interesting questions for me are questions about governing emerging technologies, so the sorts of technologies where we can't predict the applications or implications of them, but nevertheless raise big social, ethical, policy questions, things like synthetic biology, geoengineering, will continue to bedevil science policymakers and science policy advisors. And then linked to that is the question of how science can be used to best inform policy without dictating or constraining it, and who should be involved in those conversations. This is, if you like, the climate gate dimension, to refer to another recent bust-up. And it's a question that, again, won't go away. Is science the sorts of thing... Is science policy the sort of thing where we can trust the experts to decide? Or do we, as a society, think that science is too important to be left to scientists? And I'll leave it there.
Does anybody have any points of clarification or direct questions to Jack on that?
Well, a very quick technical
Can we have a microphone? Sorry.
Well, it was just a technical question.
That's exactly the sort of thing we want just before we move on to the next panel.
Are you going to be listing these questions, you know, on...
on
an etherpad or something like that, so we know what they are? Because you said two questions for each, but actually there were about four questions in that, and I just want to know what we're addressing.
I'm trying to keep notes as we go, but I haven't got it linked up to the projector. I could ask all of them to restate their two central questions very neatly, or as neatly as they can, after all four of them have gone. It would help refresh everybody's minds. That might be the only way of doing this.
Alice, is the adapter still up there as well? Wine adapter? Is there a wine adapter up there with it? No, someone took it.
Okay. I don't have mine with me. We could plug it into.
Well, we can borrow. Do you want to go live with it, or do you want to just?
I don't know if I want to go live with my spelling, but I could try.
It's up to you.
Do you think that's a good point?
How about this? We'll continue to do sort of questions, and then if you want to decide.
I can try and fit this up while people present. Okay, well, I'll move now on to Victoria Johnson from the New Economics Foundation, and I'll let her pose her two questions.
Okay, I don't know whether any of you are familiar with the New Economics Foundation, so I'll just give you a little bit of background. I'm currently head of the Climate Change and Energy Programme at NEF, and we are basically a think tank, an independent think tank, that... tries to bring the social, economic, and environmental spheres together. So we always take an approach where we're sort of trying to maximise what we call well-being, social inequality, well-being. Sorry, I've said that. Environmental sustainability and economic prosperity. And so my background really isn't science policy, although I was a scientist once a few years ago, but. So my questions are probably going to seem a little bit basic, but I think we can talk about them later. But so my first question really was with the spending cuts and or potential spending cuts, and as Jack already said, alluded to the steady state of science, reduced funding, and the kind of the growth of commercialization of research. How will the stronger commercial priorities being accepted for university research affect the breadth of the research agenda? And I'm aware of some research that was done by the Scientists for Global Responsibility about commercialisation of research and commodification of information. And I know we've talked about, I know that this morning you heard all about open access and open science, but for me, that's one of the key questions. I don't know the answer to that, but I think that's something that's very important, particularly given that there's more sort of public-private sector funding in that area. And the second question really is actually something that I'm really interested in. I don't really know very much about, and I really like to sort of to hear what people think about this. And I'd actually really like someone to do some research in it. Probably not me, but. With the publication of the Sustainable Development Commission, which is now extinct, but the publication of their Prosperity Without Growth document, which talks about moving towards a low growth or no growth economy because of the links between growth and environmental resource use and the unequal distribution of wealth and GDP is a bad indicator. And also the work that Peter Victor, who's a Canadian economist, has done on managing without growth. My question really was something that I haven't really seen talked about in that context, because the growth, sort of challenging economic growth issue is actually definitely a growing field now. It was something that started back in the days of the Club of Rome and has been going on for some time, but it's sort of had a resurgence, particularly with the current economic economic crisis, and people are looking at alternative models of economic development. What does science policy look like in a steady state economy, and how would you fund it? How would you decide how it's funded? And I guess it kind of links very much to what Jack just said in his last question. So those are my two questions, and I hope they make sense.
Any questions for Vicky? No, okay, I'll move now on to Stephen Hill from Research Councils UK, although he is very much talking from his own perspective.
Thanks, Alice. Yes, I'm from Research Councils UK, where I head the Research Councils UK strategy unit. Just to give you a little bit of background, Research Councils UK is the partnership of the seven UK research funders, seven public funders of research, and the strategy unit works to support the councils in working together collectively on a range of research policy and other issues. So I don't think I've come up with particularly new questions, but I think they are important questions, and they are related to some of the things you've already heard. And the first one is about the international context in which we fund research and science domestically. We're in a situation where there are other parts of the world that have very rapidly expanding research funding systems. They're investing much higher proportions of their economic growth into funding research, places like China and India. They're moving from a situation where initially they were funding very high volumes of not particularly good quality research, but that's now changing. The quality is improving. And so I think within the UK and within Europe, we have some decisions to make about whether we want a science policy that focuses on improving the competitiveness of science within our nation or within Europe. So that's to say to outdo these other nations that are investing vast amounts of money and talent into research. Or alternatively, we can open up our borders in terms of research and move towards a more collaborative way of thinking about our research relationships with other nations. And I guess the situation at the moment is that we're not at either end of that spectrum, but we're probably a bit closer to the idea of supporting the competitiveness of UK scientists and researchers. And I think that there's a question there about how you handle research policy in that context. And then there's a separate question, and I think it is a separate question, about innovation policy in that context, because clearly innovation is something that is related to economic growth, which is one of the major reasons that government is supportive of research funding. Although I should say, I think Vicky's question about zero growth and what research looks like in zero growth conditions is a really important and interesting question. So that's my first question. And like Jack, I managed to get about four in there if you're paying attention. My second question, that was a very outward-looking question. My second question is perhaps looking more inward within the UK. We're a decade ago, what was then the public understanding of science movement translated into a movement around public engagement and encouraging dialogue between the public and scientists and researchers. And there's been some huge steps forward in that time. But the most recent public attitudes to science survey that was carried out by Ipsos Mori found that 66% of the people questioned felt that they wanted to have more influence on the direction of research within the country. So I think there's a really interesting question about, should we take that finding seriously? Should we actually be looking to support that 66% of people and give them more of a say in the setting of research policy and strategy? And if the answer to that question is yes, how do we do that? What are the processes that we might use to break down what is quite an insular process? So those are my two questions.
And any quick points to Stephen? Okay, and finally we have Beck Smith from the Biochemical Society.
Hi everybody, so I bet you're thinking the last one she's going to give us policy questions related to open science, but actually I'm not, and hopefully they will come from you afterwards. My two questions are, as scientific knowledge deepens and expands, the training period and the amount of time it takes scientists to become experts in increasingly narrow fields is going to increase. In light of this, and recognising that the training period is going to lengthen as a result of this, how do we continue to incentivise entry into a scientific career as opposed to other careers? And could this change disproportionately affect certain groups, for example, women? And this is linked to, for example, increasing age of Nobel Prize winners and age that people apply for their first patent as kind of a backup. And my second question is, mine are much shorter than everybody else's. Science is increasingly becoming a kind of global team game. And what science policy do we need in place, or how can current science policy evolve to support this? And are rewards such as the Nobel Prize too individualistic?
All right, well, thank you. I am quickly typing these up, and I'm about to put them on the screen as soon as I've just checked that my spelling isn't too atrocious, but you'll have to bear with me that it will be quite bad. As I start to do that, does anybody have any initial responses to those? Do you see similar trends in those questions? Do you agree with them? Do you disagree with them? Do you want to play with the big gaping hole that Beck flagged up that we didn't mention open access? It's over to you. Oh, we have you first, yes.
So, Peter Murray Rust, chemist, campaigner for openness. So I'd like to pick up on what Stephen said about the involvement of the community and where science goes. And I would say, should we make science more democratic? We're in a situation now where science is practiced probably by, 1% of the population, and they report science generally to their peers. They do not involve people outside, and we've seen the growth of citizen science. We've seen the democratic conflict between researchers on climate and, the world in general who wants to be part of this process, and that's mirrored in things like patient groups who cannot get access to the information that they pay for and so on. So can we actually have a policy of trying to be much more inclusive of the people who actually pay our salaries?
Somebody's phone's ringing. I think that follows on from things that both Stephen and Jack said. Do you two want to comment on that, or...?
Well, I think my comment would be, I agree with what you say, and I think, Beck said there was a void in the questions that wasn't a question about open access. Well, in a sense, my question was about open access, because one of the ways in which we can make science more democratic and get people more involved in setting research policy questions and setting research questions is through being more open. And that's not just about opening up publications, important as that is, but it's about opening up the earlier stages, how science funding works, how science strategies are set, and also getting scientists to work more openly in what they do in the process of their scientific research. So by blogging, using whatever tools they want to use about how their research is progressing, that will increase the accountability and increase the visibility of what I think you rightly describe as a sort of black box.
And what I would add to that is that, I mean, if you take the open science motif and you translate it into the world of direct public engagement, the democracy agenda, I think there's still a gulf between the way that open science is talked about, which is largely openness in terms of, well, what you might call transparency. It's open like a greenhouse is open. Which is a slightly different thing from openness in terms of open-mindedness. Are scientists genuinely interested in what non-experts have to say about the direction that their research should be going in, the things that they should be looking at, the people that should be included, and those sorts of things. And I think that's the focus for the genuine democratic debate about science. So I would say that, you know, transparency is perhaps one step on the road towards that. But if it's done disingenuously, transparency can actually be a step backwards. Because quite often you see within the scientific community the publication and release of information as being a way to, they would consider, placate a sceptical public rather than genuinely to involve a sceptical public.
Do people agree with that? There's a difference between... The open access is sometimes used rhetorically just as a way of assuming that it's okay that you're being open and it's not genuinely engaging with people. Are there similar people worrying about that or feel that that's okay, that having information out there is enough, that our notion of access and how we define that is enough? Am I ringing off something completely different?
I'm afraid that open access won't be enough. For example, I once sat with my sister in the car and we listened to the radio, and one girl was described who just won a grant for researching, I think, the Dutch participle of in the 13th century. And my sister was really open what she would do, but my sister said, why would I pay with my tax anyone to do investigate that? There's so many problems in our country, so many things to do investigate. So openness does not say that people will be glad with what they are hearing, that science are doing. So that's my concern.
Well, maybe fits into Stephen's question about whether we want to give that 66% of people who want more of a role on research funding, do we want to give them that, or research science policy, do we want to give them that power?
Who's paying salaries in the end?
But it's, you know, so we've got two maybe opposing views there in some ways. We need to make, science should be open and accountable to those who are paying salaries, and then yet also are they?
Well, there's
a difficult question.
I mean, the other view, which is the conventional conservative view that people might be willing to own up to, is the view that, you know, we pay scientists and trust that they have our interests at heart and let them get on with it, and that's the best way to do things. So there may well be people in the audience that believe that that's the best way to proceed.
That's kind of like you asked the question of whether science is something that we can trust experts just to do, or whether it's too important to be left to the scientists. Is there a way of getting my screen up on there? Anybody? Aha, there we go. typed quickly. Probably many missing words, but yeah, that's where we were. There was that question, and that would be interesting if I could put that through to the audience, if people agree with that or think that's a good question, or whether they have an opinion either side on that, that it's something that you can leave to scientists, because I think that relates to Stephen's question quite strongly. And perhaps even Vicky's one about will it affect the breadth of the research agenda? I mean, maybe another way of making the research agenda more broad or more narrow is to ask other people who would be involved in that. It's not just about commercial interests, but public interests.
Cameron Allen. I guess open advocate and blogger and ranter in general. So I think it's a really important question, and I have opinions. I sit on both sides. I mean, it's a question that runs to the heart of what representative democracy is about. We don't run the country on the basis of plebiscites. We elect supposedly expert people to take charge of making the decisions. Based on some sort of process. And I guess you can argue about whether the architecture that is in this country versus the US is better. You probably have different views on that depending on whether you're asking the question 3 years ago or last week. But it's a question about architecture. And I guess the question that, for me, links a bunch of these things together is once you've asked the question of what is science for, which I think is a question we do need to ask because we don't really address it, but we need to start asking the question of what's the optimal architecture for the community and the process to deliver on that. And my personal view is that once you start asking that question, then openness follows as a necessary consequence of optimising the architecture. Mm. But that seems to be the big question that links a set of these things together.
Does anyone in... Stephen, you? Yeah.
I just wanted to come back to this, which is related to your point, this question about, you know, should we just, you know, throw money at scientists and leave them alone and they'll do the best thing, or the other extreme, should we, you know, take control, and is that taking control in the sense of political control, you know, our elected representatives taking charge of what needs to be done, or through more open democratic processes. But I think, you know, one of the important things is to remember that those aren't necessarily mutually exclusive, that you can actually do both of those. You know, I think there's a quote attributed to Henry Ford, I don't know whether it's true or not, that he said that, you know, if I'd asked people what they wanted, I would have made a faster horse. As opposed to creating the Model T Ford, which was, you know, this sort of innovative leap. So I think there is an argument that says that there is some value in allowing, you know, fundamental research, allowing researchers to follow their interests, to do crazy things just because they're curious about it, because that will throw up some interesting things. But on the other hand, I think this is, you know, public money, it is taxpayers' money, and therefore addressing, as the other comment from the front said, addressing the problems that people consider to be important is also something that we need to do. And I think, you know, perhaps another big question in science policy, I'll just sneak another one in, is how do you get the balance between those two objectives, between you know, how much money, you know, given the fixed pot, do you put into allowing scientists to follow their curiosity versus directing towards addressing the issues of society? It's, you know, it's what we, the research councils, grapple with all the time.
We've got a question from there, but just as the microphone makes its way over, I wondered if Vicky or Beck had anything to say on those issues or any of the similar issues that have just come up.
I think, I can't remember which research council it was, but they did an experiment where they brought in a group of lay people and asked three sets of scientists to pitch research to them, and they had a certain pot of money, and they would fund one of these three sets of scientific research. And I think the research council had an idea of what may be the most effective way of spending that money of the three groups of scientists. And it was a group of scientists who I think were looking at using fluorescence to track drug metabolism through the body. And that was the one that won, and they felt that was the one that won because it was, at the risk of sounding horribly patronising, that was the one that was the easiest for the public to understand. The other ones didn't have the sorts of diagrams and explanations that this particular group had. And I think that those sorts of experiments can be quite damaging. But it's an interesting experiment. I wonder if anyone has any other examples of methods of which they've tried to involve the public in this, what should we be spending our money on? Because I think a lot of effort tends to be focused on let's talk about the potential implications of the application of this science rather than at the other end.
That's a really good point. And there's some hands going up. So we'll go to the question that we had, and then that's another thing we can bring up later.
Hello. I just have a comment to what just has been said. And this discussion reminded me about something that came up at the Science Communication Conference in May, where someone said that he wouldn't read the whole dossier on the Iraq politics, but he would trust his MP, which was elected, to understand and make the appropriate decisions. And in a way, if you have PDFs, even if they're open access, even scientists don't always understand the specific literature, and so you wouldn't expect anyone from the public to understand it. So maybe there's also an issue about image of scientists and the trust the public puts in it, and if different disciplines of science have different images or are being trusted differently, which I think might also have to be taken into account when you talk about open access. So does the public feel that scientists are representing their interests, or do they not feel like that? Does it make sense?
Do the panel want to answer that, or anybody else want to answer that? I guess another question from that is, with the Iraqi dossier question, is whether you trust your MP to be able to deal with the science in a way that they might be, as professional politicians, able to deal with the politics in a different way. I know that's something that concerns a lot of people, and maybe it's a red herring, but it's certainly one that's often talked about. Did you have something to follow on from that?
There's a fundamental difference here in that the MPs were elected and the scientists were not elected to represent society.
But maybe they're publicly funded, so are we asking for some kind of... To go back to Beck's question, are people aware of projects that have
and try to involve the public, not in doing science, in citizen science, and not necessarily that's the focus, and not an idea of talking about the social and ethical consequences of it, but actually framing the research agenda.
Something very close. There's a large body of work by a fellow in Texas who, in terms of understanding complex regulatory decisions such as public power, devised a way to take a statistical sample of an affected community, bring them together for a week, weekend or something, where they trained them in all of the issues involved, which were incredibly complex, and then polled them at the end to find out what they thought should be done on the various decision points. And first of all, they got it. They were perfectly able to understand it with all that support structure. But it turned out to be a very good way to get public opinion and understanding on an issue. And then they just published in a user-friendly way the results of that. And I think there are a lot of techniques. And Nayland says, you know, let's think about what our goal is, because there will be ways to build in citizens, I think, a number of architectural ways to do it, and that's just one.
Behind you. Yeah. And then, Jenny and Henry, and then we'll go back to Jack.
Jenny Woods, I'm coordinator of one of the EPSRC's, what do we call ourselves, Grand Challenge Networks. So we're funded by the research councils in different areas of science, and I look after a bit of chemistry, chemical engineering, to take a 50-year forward look into the future as to where we think the subject area is going to develop, where the research councils should be targeting their money. And as part of that, obviously, we're going out to the academic community, talking about to them about what they're doing and where they think the breakthroughs should be. But a couple of weeks ago, I went and I spoke in a public situation it was the Reading Geeks Society, so actually they were quite technologically literate, but not necessarily scientifically literate, and explained what we were doing, asking them to help me do that 50-year forward look. And they came back with some phenomenal stuff that we can be doing with our materials science. And actually, it was almost quite embarrassing. There was a big emphasis on helping the third world, areas that we perhaps of society that we as focused scientists weren't necessarily looking at, but all incredibly relevant stuff. So actually, you can go back and say that the research councils are already involving the public in doing some of your forward look work. So that might be a positive thing to feedback.
And there are various structures for having lay members or other stakeholder members, they're called different things in different contexts, on the research funding peer review colleges. Did you want to add to me before we go to Henry?
I was just going to follow up that there are on the councils of the various research councils, there are in many cases people who are certainly not professional scientists, and in some cases you might classify as lay members. Views differ on what the appropriate proportion of those people is, and there are some councils where there have been issues where there's a view that there aren't enough scientists, and that's gone backwards and forwards. But it's a way where people are being involved, and I think it's safe to say it's proving a bit contentious in some cases.
Can I just I've been involved with various of these attempts to, like you were describing with the deliberative polling example, try to get public deliberation to engage with particular science governance decisions, particularly around nanotechnology, where there was, for a brief spell, huge enthusiasm. Now, this is now institutionalised within UK government in a way that it isn't in any other country in the world. So we have a programme called ScienceWise that does public dialogue on particular policy decisions. But the criticism of ScienceWise and equivalent efforts around the world is that the public part of those conversations simply hasn't had much traction. So as a mechanism for changing political decision making, it's a rather weak one. And I think the more interesting example, there are more interesting examples of social innovation in this space. And the one that I always point to is the Alzheimer's Society, who run a network in which they use patients and carers within their peer review system to, at every stage, sift proposals, improve proposals, to join scientific teams, to monitor the progress of projects. And it changes the science that they fund. You know, that's a genuinely transformative democratic effort. Now, you probably wouldn't want to organise your whole research system in that way, but as one part of the research system, it's a very good way of introducing diversity, I would say.
And Henry, did you have an example from charities? Because I think that's an interesting difference of charities and research councils, and maybe they're different architecture, or maybe they can learn from each other.
It's a similar idea, but it's not quite there yet. I work at Cancer Research UK, and we have a small fundraising website that we put up a couple of years ago. It's a bit of an experiment. It's called My Projects, and what essentially it is, we sort of cherry pick projects, a bit like MySpace, but My Projects meant to be all kind of Web 2 and stuff. So what it essentially is we sort of cherry pick a series of projects that we're already funding, and put them on the website with video content of the scientists talking about their research, and we allow people to build social networks around those giving and allow build giving groups around it, and to raise money specifically for those projects. Now, obviously, this isn't putting forward proposals and getting them peer reviewed by the public. It's a couple of steps away from that. But what has been interesting is the appetite of people to get involved on a per project basis like this, rather than just giving money to a central pot and expecting us to divvy it all up on their behalf. But also, we've started to get people asking, well, you haven't got one on stomach cancer. Can you find one for stomach cancer, please? So we'll go through our research database and find a sort of suitable stomach cancer program and put it on there. So it's not public peer review. It's a fundraising website, and moreover, it's kind of replacement fundraising, so that this money is replacing money that's already going to that project and freeing up money for elsewhere. But it just starts to show that there is public appetite to get involved with this kind of stuff and to build networks around it. And I think it's quite interesting. And given the budget that the team that are up behind this have had, it's been very successful, and it's going to be quite interesting to see how that, especially given the scientists are now getting used to being emailed for updates about their research that aren't peer-reviewed updates, but they're going out directly to the people giving. It's quite an interesting model for engagement, and I think we can do a lot more with it over the years. At the moment, it's very much seen as a fundraising tool, but I think the potential for engagement with the nuts and bolts of how science works is quite interesting there.
That's really interesting from a communication point of view. I think Jack's example was too, because I can imagine that if everyone's going through the detail of peer review like that, you need to have people learning a lot, and also scientists communicating in ways that are not just for their peers, in maybe slightly different ways than they would normally.
Can I ask a question of Henry? You say that you cherry pick them, and with the understanding that it is a fundraising effort, on what criteria do you cherry pick them?
Stuff that, and going back to the earlier example, sort of say stuff that's easy to understand, stuff that people can relate to. It tends to be the more clinical end of our research portfolio rather than the more basic stuff. And it's very much sort of very, very relevant to people's lives. And I think, obviously, given how much basic research we fund, I can't see how this model would be. You could extend it across our whole portfolio. But I think it's a really interesting way that people are engaged with it. But yeah, absolutely. When we sort of think, when we got that question, can you find us a stomach cancer project to fundraise against? The first thing we went to was the clinical trials and looked at that end of stuff rather than the kind of real molecular stuff that we fund as well.
Okay, thanks.
I think it sounds really interesting, and I think there's a lot of scope for expanding that type of activity. You know, I just wonder whether at some point it would be worth trying one of those more basic bits of research, and actually, you know, you would need scientists involved who had real flair for communicating it and actually getting the importance of that fundamental science into a format that the general public could relate to, because I think what you're talking about is you need something that is relatable to for those people. But I think it would be a really interesting experiment to try and do that, because it may not be, if you can identify the right communicators, it may not be as hard as you might initially think.
I think you're absolutely right. I'd like to see that happen. I think we're an environment where freedom to experiment and innovate in the sort of current fundraising climate is, shall we say, slightly limited.
Because it's very easy to say, oh, well, you work for a cancer charity, it's really easy for you, but as Stephen says, it's maybe worth trying. And did you have a...
Thanks. Mary Williams, I work for the Biotechnology and Biological Sciences Research Council, and I'm hearing a lot of really very interesting ways about how we can be a bit more... responsive and direct our public engagement programs. And all the research councils actually do quite a lot of public engagement, and a recent one that's been quite successful is the public dialogue around synthetic biology. But there are some the really nice ideas about consulting more widely raise really big practical questions And if you want genuine public involvement in helping to prioritize our research programs, we need to be thinking around how do you involve the public, not in looking at one or two hand-picked projects. How do you get the public involved in deciding which 15 to 20% of several thousand applications a year that come through our doors? How do you do that? And if there are good ideas around that, that would be fantastic. Thank you.
You know, it's maybe back to an architecture, or the detail of Cameron's architecture point. What are the practical points of how we build this? Does anyone have any ideas about that? I mean, one thing is something I've heard many people say in the last year is that we need to get less research bids, because scientists take a lot of time putting research bids together, which never get funded, and people have to spend a lot of time sifting through that. Maybe if we did more with less, that would be easier to manage those practical accountability things. If nobody's got any things on... Oh, you have? Yeah? No, go ahead. I was going to...
Obviously, I'll chat for the next 20 minutes about this, but something I particularly... I mean, in relation to the point, in a sense, that you're raising there, how do you scale it up? And not just sort of, oh, here's three projects we've picked, you members of the public, which is the best one. I mean, this comes back to Jack's question, I think, what is science for? And if what you want to do is get the biggest and the broadest involvement, I think what you need to do is come up with things that aren't asking the public to pick which of these things we're funded, but ask the public what they think science is for, and have some kind of, I don't know, whether it's workshops or plays or, art that people do or something. If people are saying, well, this is what we think science is for, then that helps to set the overall kind of picture of what are we going to try and fund. Does that make sense?
So you get them on the big picture rather than the little one, and then you don't have to worry about the number of...
Well, yeah, but you use different things to deal with the details. You know, you can have citizens' juries or whatever for the details, but if you want to get a large number of people involved in, And I do think that... I mean, Stephen was saying, then Henry might be able to get a paper, a study that was quite abstract or obscure, funded by the people on your website, if the scientist who is presenting it is a good communicator. I mean, those of you who don't know, I'm involved in running I'm a Scientist, Get Me Out of Here, which is, as far as we know, the only program in the world where young people have any kind of decision-making power over science funding. And, obviously I think it's brilliant, but I have to say, honestly, that it is not the scientist with the most kind of crucial world-defining... science who wins their zone. It's the scientist who communicates best and is most personable and pleasant. So at the very specific level, there's that kind of huge influence of just personality and communicative style, whereas at the bigger level, you maybe get better answers. Does that make sense?
Well, it's like, as Beck said earlier, she sort of worries about the charisma and the fact that people would understand it and how that would come in.
Can I pick up on the question that Stephen asked with the 66%? Was there a follow-up question asking people how they'd like to be involved?
No.
I just wondered.
In that survey, I was on the steering group for that survey, so I got a little bit too interested in it. The interesting finding for me for that survey is that a lot of people want science funding, just in broad brush terms, a lot of people want science funding to be more open. Not very many people want to be involved directly themselves, is the lesson. And it is for anybody that's thinking through these sorts of models of direct democracy, they would be wrong to pretend that there is a drooling public out there desperate to get involved in decisions about what research to fund, because that public probably doesn't exist at the top level. There will be particularly interested groups in particular areas, particularly, obviously, patient groups. But for most people, it is this point about wanting to know that science funding is being done in an open way, that things about what society wants from science are being put up there alongside what scientists want from science and what the Treasury wants from science. And the public concern is quite often that those last two things trump the former one.
Isn't that partly, though, that we just don't know how we might do it? I mean, I know that just personally, that I like the idea that I could have power over science policy, but there's whole areas which I wouldn't know where to start. And maybe if there were people who could explain the relevance and what they do in more detail, if people were more open about this black box of science, then I'd know where to go. And I mean, I know
several degrees in this black box of science, and I'm still pretty lost on a lot of it. If it was more open, then the public would know where they might be able to have more impact, particularly as we can see where it is a bit more open on medical charity work in particular, people do get involved. Maybe they would get more involved in other issues. I wonder if it's partly a communication lack that prompts that. That's just guessing.
But there's also a whole set of different levels of question buried in this, because you know there are questions around particular projects, and I think the point Mary raises about the scale of trying to get some sort of engagement around particular projects, and you know, similarly the work you're doing at CRUK, it sounds like it's framed around particular projects. But there are different sorts of questions, like you know, what's the balance of research funding that should go into cancer research versus nanotechnology, you know, accepting that's probably an overlap between those two things. You know, how do you engage people in that type of discussion? And that is, in some ways, it's easy because it's big picture and very high level. But in other ways, it's very challenging because it doesn't link to concrete outcomes and things that people can directly relate to.
Henry, have a follow-up point, and then I'm going to move the topic on a bit.
A really interesting example of that coming up quite soon with the government's consultation on value-based pricing, drugs pricing stuff, which is, for those that don't know about it, it's the government's, the coalition government's proposals to work out how to pay for treatments on the NHS. It's sort of the successor to the current model of NICE, although NICE will be involved in it. Because what you've got there is a real tension between the need to make treatments available at a price that the NHS can afford, but then you have the other competing need to stimulate research innovation, and you need to actually make sure that researchers are getting value for their intellectual property, companies can be spun out, and goes back to what you're talking about, innovation policy and growth. How does this all tie together? And you're going to get completely competing sets of priorities, which are going to be over most people's heads, but actually the public need to get engaged with this, because it's going to be how the health service is run, but it has direct ramifications all the way up to research policy, innovation policy, and everything else. And it's, at the moment, no one has a clue about any of this stuff.
I wanted to move on to some of the other questions, and maybe that's a good way of moving on to, say, Vicky's point about narrowing potentially the breadth of our research agenda in a time when we don't feel like we have many options, and potentially also with the impact of commercialization, and maybe also similarly her question about what does science look like in a zero growth economy. I wondered if anybody had any views about that.
Actually, before you even started that debate, I wanted to pull up the panel members on their use of language. The two of you are very heavily involved in policy side, both used an expression that actually made the hairs on the back of my neck kind of stand on end, which was steady state funding. About a year ago, a whole gang of us in this room and very many other people stood outside the Treasury singing slightly in tune, trying to persuade them to hold or even increase science funding with the, you know, the range of cuts that are going on. As I remember it, the grant line was held steady. Capital investment was very, very heavily cut, which at the time we welcomed, and then we realised that also in the Treasury they were folding the equipment line out of the grant funding also within the capital budget, which actually means that last year our grant funding was very heavily hit, and in a real terms situation, it's dropping year on year. It is not a steady state funding solution. It is a dropping funding situation, and we shouldn't lose track of that. So please don't use that phrase, steady state funding, especially near any ministers.
Well, do you want to pick up on what you mean by steady state? Because it's in some ways jargon, or elaborate on Jenny's point about that.
I guess it is shorthand, because steady state has a particular science policy meaning, which is largely to characterise what happened in the 1980s following the post-World War II massive increases in science funding, because of the, you know, the endless frontier, science was going to offer every solution to every problem, and then the scepticism that arrived in both the Reagan administration and the Thatcher administration led to a levelling off in the 80s, and so that's steady state. And then New Labour decided to accelerate in the UK and double science funding over 10 years, which in effect never finished, because we were given this flat cash settlement, which, you know, in the context of public spending across the board was actually a good result. And so steady state isn't a mathematical observation there. It's a sort of policy shorthand for the sorts of conditions that we find ourselves in now. Whereas rather than on a rising tide, we are in a situation in which money has to be taken from one person to pay another person.
I'd just like to second the point that it's not helpful shorthand for the states. I think it's really quite inaccurate, as has been pointed out. I think you need something better.
Well, I guess it's this is a problem of jargon coming out into other contexts. And certainly a lot of people who... Well, maybe putting
yeah,
that...
Yeah, no, the reality is cuts, and nobody is under any illusion. But
I think other people are, they accept the top-line political comment that there are no real cuts. Things are maintained at a stable state.
Do you think?
No. Well, either that brings us back to public engagement issues or public communication issues about how you communicate research funding to people and the politics of that... And as Jenny mentioned, people going out in the street and shouting for science funding. It's an interesting phenomenon that happened in the UK, that a load of people went and protested for science funding. But I think they were largely from the scientific community, although they also did quite a good job of trying to show that the larger public was interested. And maybe that's either back to public engagement in a more promotional end of things question, or we could focus back on and talk about cuts and say, well, what does science look like in cuts? Maybe trying to avoid different loaded terms. You can choose your own loaded term and say, well, what does it look like in our current economy? I mean, how are we going to deal with the infrastructure to problems and things?
I will sort of go back to that top question from Vicky, which I think is a really interesting one. I could phrase it in a slightly different way. How do you make the choice? You know, David Willetts has talked a lot about absorptive capacity and ensuring the expertise as a mechanism for making sure we can exploit external innovation as well, and that's clearly an important thing. And at the same time, people have talked about ensuring that we only fund the best quality science, whatever that means. Let's assume we can actually measure that. Mm. But those things tension against each other. You know, we can't have both diversity and maximise quality. So how do we address that question, and how do we manage? Interested in the economic perspective on what the tension is there.
Do you want to respond to those to that? Yeah. Vicky first, and then Jack.
Someone else want to go first?
Do you want Jack go first, and then Vicky?
Can, yeah. I think you picked up on a really interesting and subtle point about the ministerial tone that was adopted immediately following the spending review, because in effect it's a question about, you know, should the science, and it links to the question about international collaboration that I think is absolutely key, should the science that we fund be good enough in order to give us the absorptive capacity, which is a horrible term, but basically to give us the ability to collaborate with the best scientists wherever they are in the world, or should we be trying to lead the charge on all fronts at once? You know, the Royal Society, unsurprisingly, made the argument that you don't get absorptive capacity without excellence. You know, that you can't just be good enough, because that won't give you the capacity to actually collaborate at the level that you need to in order to carry on doing the best science and hopefully making the most of all of that in terms of economic growth and societal benefits and all the rest. And I don't know where we are on that. I mean, I know that, you know, scientists on the whole, when they collaborate, like collaborating with the best people, and the globalization of it, I think, probably makes excellence just as important. That, you know, even though certain people argue that the world is flattening, I would argue that actually the peaks in terms of science look all the more important as the collaborators broaden.
Vicky, did you want to add things?
I'm all right.
Okay. Does anybody have any more on the financial issues? Or possibly globalisation has come up again and again. Yeah, we have.
In just 3 minutes.
Yeah.
It's more for the live streaming.
Oh, yeah. Hi, my name's Rob. I'm from Oxford. I am entirely new to thinking about any of this, so excuse my total ignorance. What's the feedback mechanism? We were talking, Cameron mentioned quality of science, and we're talking about being the best at things and how you decide what goes and what stays. What is the feedback mechanism? How do you know when something you've given money to as a research council has delivered well or not? Because don't they just have to say whether they did what they said they were going to do? And so, okay, they can do it or they can not do it. Well, that's easy. But how on earth do you know if they're good or not? That's nonsense, isn't it? Unless you have some very, very elaborate way of measuring the quality of science that I'm unaware of, which, as a scientist, I wish I was aware of. Is it just citations?
That is a wonderful can of worms to finish on. Well, actually, what I was going to say was, well, we've only got a few more minutes. Should we have any immediate responses, maybe starting with Stephen, on that question? And then I'm going to ask the panel if they've got any ways they change their questions to conclude. So, yeah, let's just respond to that, how you measure the quality.
It's a great question, and I wish I had an answer to it, but because if I did, then, you know, we could do things a lot better. But I think, you know, that there is the peer review process at the outset in terms of selecting projects, and what that does is by no means perfect, and I certainly wouldn't sit here and say it was, but what it does is it allows us to identify only those projects that are of the very highest standards and have the very highest potential.
That doesn't say anything to the proportion you would give to one area of science to another, because peer review is within an area of science.
Yeah, and I think that, so, you know, in terms of knowing whether you're getting excellent research and looking at the research system as a whole, then I think citations are a very good way of doing it. But I think, you know, I think one of the things that you're going back to the question from, or the comment from Neera, the second row there, was that we've not been very good in this country at taking strategic decisions about funding particular areas of science and not funding other areas of science. And that's partly because we don't necessarily have the evidence base that allows us to take that sort of decision in a really robust way. But the attempts that are made to do that, and I think, you know, EPSRC's recent work on their so-called Shaping Capability Initiative is a very well-based and robust approach at looking within a particular set of disciplines, setting some clear criteria up front, and then gathering evidence to look at those criteria and to take decisions on the relative magnitudes of different parts of the portfolio. And I think that's the sort of thing that we should be moving towards. But, and this is a big but, you know, you only have to open up the pages of Research Fortnight or Times Higher Education to discover that is intensely unpopular within the research community, particularly, of course, those bits of the research community that are receiving less funding as a result of those strategic decisions. So, you know, it is possible to do it, but it's not easy, either from a technical point of view in doing it or from a handling point of view in terms of how you deal with the outcomes.
I think, as ever with the Science Question Time project, or any science policy debates, perhaps, we end up with way more questions than answers. I don't think we've had any answers today, really. Maybe a few clues towards framing better ones, though. And I just quickly, before we finish, I wanted to ask the panel if they would adapt their questions in light of this conversation, although that is open for them to think about and get back to us on later. But if right now they had any extra comments on these things.
Just to follow up on that question, that, for me, is the big one. That's the really big one, is that if over the course of the spending review, government had to decide how to change its spending on science. What it decided to do was flat cash, which we know is real term cuts and cut capital, but, you know, whatever. It decided to duck the decision about whether it should give more money to somebody and less money to somebody else, whether to change the balance within research councils, except it slightly fudged it by giving the MRC a little bit more money. But anyway, I think the big decision from now on is, given that we, in our current economic situation, won't be able to fund all areas of science, which are all becoming more expensive across the board, how do we make strategic decisions about what the UK is good at, what we should be doing, and what we're willing to see wither? Because I think that's something that very few people are willing to talk about. Certainly science ministers aren't willing to discuss. You know, by accident, we have a situation where the UK is, on the whole, better on the biomedical side than it is on the physical side. We have people like Cancer Research UK and Wellcome Trust who slightly changed the balance there. But that's, you know, accidental. It's not strategic. I think the next step is to make it an explicit decision.
Well, I think we're going to have to finish then. So I will bully our panellists to reflect more on their questions later. We'll put it up on a blog post on the Campaign for Science and Engineering website, if I can kick their director into actually posting the blog post. Can you give a round of applause to our panellists? Thank you. Thank you for all your questions too.